This is Cultural Mixtapes. I'm Tejas Srinivasan. Welcome to the show. In August 2023, West Virginia University announced that it would be dissolving its Department of World Languages, Literature, and Linguistics. And a couple months after that, my school, Middlebury College, chose to eliminate a faculty position in its creative writing department. As someone studying English literature and who cares deeply about the future of humanities education, I was curious to talk to someone who has been thinking about what the study of humanities looks like in today's world. Merve Emre is the Shapiro Silverberg University Professor of Creative Writing and Criticism at Wesleyan University and a contributing writer at The New Yorker. She was also a judge for the 2022 International Booker Prize. I've read her essays on various literary topics at The New Yorker and other publications, and it's obvious that her criticism strives to innovate literary study for a changing world. I've been talking a lot about criticism on the show this year. I spoke to Christian Lorentzen over the summer about the future of literary criticism, an art that's been required to reinvent and revitalize itself over the past few years. And my conversations with Jerome Lowenthal and Ethan Iverson focused on how classical music and jazz are received. I think studying the way we approach and talk about art and culture is crucial to the function of the humanities, and this conversation gets to the heart of that. Merve and I start by talking about the school and the trends that literature departments are seeing, but then we progress to a larger discussion about access to the humanities. Merve is a strong advocate for treating aesthetic experience as a social good, and this takes us to the end of our conversation, where we try to articulate how the academy and public media and social media can simultaneously further the reach and scope of humanities education and dissemination in their own ways. You'll see by the end of our conversation that this was another work of audio criticism. Regardless of whether you're interested in literature or culture, the topics we discussed are ubiquitous in today's society, and if there's one through line in all the episodes of Cultural Mixtapes, it's the importance of art in our world. This conversation was a pleasure, and any books or articles that we mention are linked in the show notes. Hope you enjoy the show. Merve Emre, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
My goal here was to talk about the future of literary criticism, and I want to do this methodically. I want to start with the school academic institutions, and your work draws quite a bit from John Guillory, who's a scholar at NYU, who wrote a book called Cultural Capital, for which you wrote the introduction. And a point that is quite important to both of you is using the school as a means to question the ways literary study has been disseminated. And so I want to start with the trends that we've seen in humanities departments of colleges in the U.S. Lots of them are being defunded. At West Virginia University, they are shutting down their Department of World Languages, Literatures, and Linguistics. And there was even a recent development here at Middlebury where a nonfiction creative writing faculty position was proposed to be eliminated. I guess, what do you see changing in universities with regards to the study of humanities, both at the undergraduate and graduate level? And can you use the word crisis to describe it?
That is a very complicated and a very rich question. I'll take your questions backwards. So the first question is, can we use the term crisis to describe what is happening? The idea of crisis to me suggests a situation that is newly arisen and that can be resolved in one way or another. It suggests too that the resolution of that crisis will usher in a new period, a rupture between the past, present, and the future. If we understand crisis in that way, then I don't think it's accurate to describe what we are seeing as a crisis. I think it is more accurate to describe what we are seeing as the continuation of trends or of historical patterns that have always been part of the humanities institutional place in the school. And in fact, some would say part of the very definition of the humanities itself. I am referencing another recent book that has come out by Chad Wellman and Paul Reiter called Permanent Crisis, in which the authors argue that the humanities self-definition since their foundation has always been in opposition to the timely and utilitarian values that have been prioritized by the rest of the school and by the market economy more generally.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing to say, that crisis probably is not the best term to use. And if we are going to use it, then we would want to use it in the way that Wellman and Ryder use it, which is as a sense of permanent crisis in the humanities. But to put a slightly finer point on that answer, I would say that we are certainly feeling it as a crisis.
Yeah.
That there are those of us who work in places where funding continues to be quite secure, but we see what's happening in places like West Virginia. We see what's happening at places like Middlebury, and we see more subtle variations of what's happening at places like West Virginia and Middlebury at even the most elite colleges and universities.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I think that we can say about the nature of this particular crisis and how we feel it is that there is a widening sense of inequality between elite private institutions and small, well-funded liberal arts colleges, which continue to do things like support language education, nonfiction writing, the literature classroom more generally, and state institutions that are and always have been beholden to state legislatures.
Yeah.
And who see their funding being cut as those legislatures insist on prioritizing programs that have some kind of obvious utilitarian, usually crudely economic value for graduating students.
Yeah.
There are two things to pull out of that answer. The first is that there is this felt sense of crisis, and that felt sense of crisis is for many people primarily and even exclusively economic. And second, that what that felt crisis is leading to is this widening inequality between different kinds of universities in the United States. The second thing that you asked is about the state of literary criticism in the school. And, you know, we just talked a little bit about the economic crisis and its relationship to various political formations and how that affects the state of literary criticism. But then there's a second kind of problem. I wouldn't call it a crisis, but there's a second kind of problem or impasse. And it's this. As we are increasingly faced with the defunding or the marginalization of language and literature and possibly other humanities disciplines, how do we explain to people what the value or the use is of what we do?
Mm-hmm.
And that is what Guillory describes as a crisis in legitimation. What legitimates what we do? Increasingly, people want to, for completely understandable reasons, legitimate what we do in terms of political thematics, that what we do, the way we teach students to read, the kinds of texts that we focus on, encourages them to think more critically and acutely about, say, ecocide and environmental crisis, about rise of various fascistic tendencies in the United States and beyond, about the intricacies of race, gender, and sexuality. And then there are also people who would want to explain or legitimate what we do by appealing to the kinds of skill sets that are useful for the kinds of service sector jobs that many college graduates go on to get. They would say that learning to read a novel is useful because it teaches you to understand something about sympathy or empathy.
Yeah.
It makes you better at communicating. It makes you better at managing people. And we can think of those justifications as being aligned with various ideas about human capital and how you make yourself a more attractive and self-actualized worker in the modern economy.
Mm-hmm.
I would offer a third scheme of valuation, and perhaps it isn't even a scheme of valuation, and that's what makes it a little bit difficult to plug into these other kinds of conversations. But I would simply say that the pleasure one gets from reading a novel or a poem, the pleasure that is that novel or poem's reason for being, justifies itself. And that the reason we teach students to read novels or poems, the reason that we write about novels and poems, is because there is pleasure in that encounter.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a pleasure that you want to transmit to other people. And with that pleasure often comes knowledge. a very fine-grained knowledge of how a novel or a poem works, about its overall artistic strategy, mm-hmm. about its place in a long history of genres and forms and other kinds of objects, and that that combination of pleasure and knowledge is valuable in and of itself. Which isn't to say that these other kinds of justifications aren't true or aren't valid or aren't strategically useful in different contexts, but for me, they don't get at what is innate or inherent to the objects that we study.
In all those points that you talked about, whether it's certain pre-professional skills that you build up, whether it's for simple pleasure or whether it's for building empathy, what seems to ground your argument, as well as in your introduction to cultural capital, as well as treating the humanities as a social good, which also sort of refers back to what you first said about inequality between different sorts of institutions. Can you say more about the humanities as a social good? Because it also, I think, opens up important questions about access and how people approach the subject.
This question goes right to the heart of a larger question, which is the question that you started with about the place of the school. One way to understand what the school does is that it unequally regulates access to certain practices of reading and writing. My students at Wesleyan, when they sit in a classroom with me and they learn how to pay attention to the structure of a sonnet, for instance, have access to that experience by virtue of the fact that they are students at that university. Mm-hmm. Not everyone has access to that kind of experience. And that experience, learning how to read a sonnet, learning not only how to identify certain formal structures in it, but also having the experience of sitting in a room with other people, gaining the pleasure that one gains from passing an idea around, that is unequally divided in our society. Some people get to have access to that and other people do not. My question is, what happens if we think about the pleasure and the knowledge that is generated by the experience of reading and writing in the school as something that should be available to everyone? What if we think about it the same way that many people on the left think about housing or healthcare or clean air? If we think about literature and its attendant pleasures in that way as a social good, then I think we will want to think more carefully about what it means to democratize access to that good. It will not be enough, I don't think, for us to say, okay, let's change the kinds of authors that we're teaching. Let's change the authors that I am teaching in the class that I teach at Wesleyan. Instead, what I would want to say is, how can I make classes like this available to as many people as possible across the widest range of socioeconomic positions possible? Then, instead of thinking about the kinds of syllabi or curricular changes I would be making in the school, I might be thinking about how to make other institutional sites the spaces of literary study. Those sites really can range. They can include a community center, they can include a bookstore, a literary festival that is open for all. They can also include adult education programs and prison literacy initiatives like the kind that Wesleyan has. So I think when you think about literature and its attendant pleasures as a social good, it will fundamentally alter the strategy that you have or the kinds of interventions that you think are essential to democratizing access to that good.
Fascinating. Coming back to what you said about academia, when you said that the study of the humanities is fundamentally against the grain of what some of these institutions are trying to do, which is pre-professional study. In another interview, you were talking about how it's difficult to see American academia functioning at the cost it's at, which also sort of relates to the inequality between institutions. What sort of ways do you see out of this bubble, or do you believe that this devaluation of the professional class of humanities is, I don't want to use the word dire, but I guess inevitable?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. And one of the things that question just really brings to light, especially in your desire to use the word either dire or inevitable, is that it's not a problem that can be addressed at the level of the university itself. Mm-hmm. Or rather, it can be addressed, but whatever solutions we come up with to address the fact that the pleasure and the knowledge claimed for the humanities does not have utilitarian value in the way that the market economy values a certain set of skills or discourses has to be put into a much larger framework of valuation. Mm-hmm. We can't really understand either crisis, either the economic crisis or the crisis of legitimation, as Guillory calls it, without understanding the structure of the American state more generally, its lack of funding for the arts, its class structure, the organization of its class structure, and the function of the school in American society more generally. I always like to tell people that my first job out of graduate school was at McGill in Montreal, where there's a significantly different relationship between the school and the state.
Okay.
One very obvious thing to point out is that the school is largely publicly funded. All schools in Canada are. Student fees are much, much lower than they are in the US, which means people really almost never have to go into debt to get a college education. And as a result, a lot of the pressure that students feel in the United States about the lack of either economic or cultural or social capital from their literature degrees is not present for students at McGill or across Canada in the same way. So understanding the lack of crisis there, relative lack of crisis there, requires understanding something about the role that the school plays in the social infrastructure more generally. I think that if there were ever to be a revaluation of the cultural capital of literary study or of the humanities more broadly, that could only happen if there were a significant structural reorganization of the American economy. And this is the conclusion at the end of Cultural Capital. Yeah. The only way for the kind of pleasure and the knowledge that I'm talking about to become social goods, shared by all, available to everyone to partake in, would be if there were a wholesale reorganization of how goods and services are consumed and produced. So Cultural Capital ends with the fantasy of an aestheticism unbound under a communist reorganization of society.
Yeah.
And it's always tempting to go straight to that point, right? To say what we need is full communism now, and then the rest of our problems are solved. But to me, it's also interesting to ask, okay, if we had the complete communist reorganization of society, everyone could be an artist, everyone could be a critic, everyone could be a writer. What would we want our art and our novels and our criticism to look like?
Yeah.
If we had the liberty to not worry about trying to justify ourselves for the purpose of getting access to certain economic or cultural rewards, what kind of work would we want to be doing? What would we want it to look like? What desires or values would we want it to affirm that are not economic values necessarily or primarily?
It's interesting because just as you say that, another slightly distant connection comes to mind. I interviewed a jazz pianist a couple months ago, Ethan Iverson, on this, and he was talking about how
I listened to that was a great interview.
He was talking about how since jazz, which used to be a behemoth of popular music, and jazz musicians were surviving on solely ticket sales, album sales throughout most of the 20th century, now requires a certain amount of charity just because it is not at the forefront of popular culture. If Guillory's utopian vision of aestheticism unbound, if that is not possible, do you think that a certain amount of charity would be necessary to develop a more equal study of the humanities? And if so, what would that look like?
I don't know if that charity would be conducive to equality, but I do think that we are entering what will be a new age of patronage.
Okay.
I think that as state infrastructure for the arts and the humanities begins to break down, many people are realizing that their only alternative sources of funding are philanthropic organizations. Mm-hmm. I sit on the board of several organizations, one of which is an extremely generous philanthropic organization. So I have seen a little bit how this works behind mm-hmm. the scenes. And I think that as we enter this new age of patronage or this age of philanthropy, what we will see will be smaller organizations, publishers, booksellers, professional organizations for translators, for agents, et cetera, looking to the large estates of very wealthy benefactors to help sustain these smaller organizations' operations. Mm. I think that what is, you know, on the one hand, it's wonderful that these organizations are stepping in where the state is failing. Mm. And by and large, many of the organizations that I work with at least have a pretty robust commitment to progressive politics. I know that's not always true, and there is plenty of money that is funding what you and I might call conservative programs or conservative projects. But the ones that I have seen are really committed to intellectual pluralism and to the freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And I find that heartening. On the other hand, these are private organizations. They are under no obligation to continue to give. And their interests are always going to be shaped by a certain set of private incentives and private interests. Yeah. So it's not like the state universally funding all universities at more or less the same level. It will create its own hierarchies, yeah. It will create its own systems of inequality, and it will be presentist in its own way.
Yeah.
I don't know how that all shakes out. I really think that we are just at the beginning of this era. And so we would need probably another 50 to 100 years to see where it goes. But I do think that the age of corporate philanthropy will be the next major age in the funding of artistic production and consumption.
Sort of moving on, part of your focus is to study the dissemination of literary criticism outside of academia. And in a New Yorker piece you wrote in January, you write that literary criticism may have to be deprofessionalized before its practitioners will allow themselves to openly embrace aesthetic judgment. And my conversation with Christian Lorentzen a couple months ago was about the function of written literary criticism today, and then about potentials to expand within different media. Talk to me about the relationship, or lack thereof, that you see between academic criticism and the criticism that's being produced outside of the academy.
I will just speak about this very autobiographically, if that's okay. So I was just talking to my students about this actually in this class that I'm teaching right now called The Critic and Her Publics. What I was trying to explain to them was that I am not an academic who does public-facing criticism. And you can see, but your listeners cannot, that I am putting massive scare quotes around public-facing criticism, because I think it's a really dangerous and unhelpful way of thinking about the relationship between the academy and the criticism that circulates outside of it. What I tell my students all the time is that I'm not an academic who does public-facing criticism. I am a person who has two jobs. Okay. I am an academic and I am a critic. And those two jobs have entirely different processes of credentialization. They have entirely different processes of producing and circulating criticism. Mm. And there are entirely different skill sets and canons associated with those two professions. As an academic, I went to graduate school, wrote a dissertation. That dissertation became my first book. I write peer-reviewed articles. And when I write those articles, what I am always thinking about is how to signal my participation in an in-group of academic professionals who are speaking about a subject on similar terms. And those terms are largely legible only to those professionals.
Okay.
That is the point of writing academic criticism. It is an exercise, or it is a genre that is produced for this in-group of professionals. It largely circulates within this in-group of professionals, and it circulates through the organs that these professionals control. And in order to write those kinds of pieces, I need to have a certain amount of field-specific knowledge. My specialty as an academic is post-1945 American literature. Mm-hmm. I need to know something about post-1945 American literature. I need to know a lot of things about it, but I also need to know what other people, other scholars have been saying about it. And I need to show that I know that through citing them.
Yeah.
When I write for The New Yorker, something entirely different is happening, which is I'm often taking the kinds of techniques or practices that I've learned as an academic. And these include paying attention to a novel in such a way that I can identify its generic affiliations. I can place it in a kind of history of the form. I can say something specific about its narrative point of view or its perspective. And I can identify important passages to walk a reader through. But I can take those skills and I can apply them to just about any kind of object. I don't have to stay specific to the field that I am trained in. I can roam across different kinds of genres and different kinds of subjects or areas. And whatever I produce, the criticism that I produce is not intended for an in-group of specialist readers, but it's intended for any reader who has no real knowledge of the subject.
Okay.
I'm offering as kind of a crash course in the subject that I am writing about. And so for me, that criticism is much more aligned with what I think of as the teaching that I do in an undergraduate classroom. It is pedagogical, it is meant to be charismatic, it is supposed to be entertaining, and it is supposed to model in its very form and style a way of reading that the person reading it can kind of pick up and apply to other things.
Yeah.
So these are two really different genres, two really different practices. And I think that it is wrong for academics to believe that they can popularize their in-group specialist discussions. I don't think they can do that, and I don't think there's any real point to doing that. But I think what they can do is that they can take the skills of reading and writing that they've learned and apply them to a different set of objects and learn a different set of writing and reading practices that can allow them to teach readers about those objects with a kind of depth and a kind of intelligence and a kind of sensitivity that I think only academic training provides.
Because Ryan Ruby wrote an article a while back called The Golden Age of Criticism, and he talked about how the Academy's loss was a public criticism's gain. And an idea that's important to your work is the fact that the literary critic outside of the Academy is very much self-authorized, and that freedom doesn't necessarily apply to academics. So how does that freedom and ability to choose aspects of culture change the abilities and reach of the deprofessionalized critic?
Well, I think there are two things to say. I mean, first, I would strongly contest the idea that we're in a golden age of criticism.
That was my next question.
I mean, like I said, I'm teaching a class right now called The Critic and Her Publics. It's a history of criticism that goes back to the 17th century and goes all the way up to the present. And I think it is very inaccurate and very dangerous to claim any age as a golden age. And it's especially inaccurate to do so based on the frequency with which certain articles circulate on a now defunct medium.
Yeah.
So I will just say that. And I would also say that the freedom of the non-academic critic always has to be thought of as the bright side or the silver lining of a lack of security. Another way to think about the distinction between a certain kind of academic critic and a certain kind of non-academic critic is that the academic critic, by virtue of their participation in those in-group conversations, has gained the job security that we call tenure. And tenure does give academics a certain freedom. They can write about whatever they want to write about, but there are probably other kinds of social and cultural pressures that strain them or that make them feel constrained. They have to continue to write in a certain way. They have to continue to write for a certain kind of outlet. And they become, as Guillory argues in his subsequent book, Professing Criticism, they do become thoroughly institutionalized creatures. So used to a certain set of norms and practices for how their writing should go, how their reading should go, how their teaching should go, that they can't quite see the variety of ways that reading and writing and teaching might be practiced. So the academic critic has, you know, up to the point of establishing job security, the lack of freedom of having to perform for the purposes of credentialization. By the point they achieve that job security, they have the lack of freedom that comes from being professionally blinkered by undergoing what Guillory describes as professional deformation. On the other side of that equation, you have the non-academic critic or the non-scholarly critic. And the freedom there is, of course, the freedom from all of the pressures of credentialization and the seeking of job security. Non-academic critic doesn't have to worry about tenure. The non-academic critic can range across a variety of subjects and topics and genres. The non-academic critic does not have to constantly signal their fidelity to or knowledge of their interlocutors, the other people who have been writing about these things. On the flip side of that, because there's no mechanism of credentialing, there's no mechanism of in-group acknowledgement, the non-academic critic does become dependent on the public in a different kind of way. So they become dependent on the number of readers. They become dependent on the number of people sharing or liking an article. They have to establish a reputation that is autonomous, or that is, as you just said, self-authorizing, because they don't have the backing of the group in the same way that the established academic critic has. Those are ideal types, and there are lots of things that complicate this, right? Including the decimation of the academic job market, which means that increasingly more and more positions are untenured positions, are never going to be secure positions. And so then the incentive to have to, the incentive to bind one to one's own unfreedom in the form of fear becomes significantly diminished. And I think that's why more people from the academy are exploring these other forms of writing. That, of course, says nothing about the quality of the writing. Also says nothing about whether or not it really is a golden age compared to other earlier periods, which I don't think it is in any way, shape, or form.
Coming back to what you said earlier about how this is not a golden age, and Christian Lorentzen agreed with you saying, but his reason for saying that was that there has to be a healthy discourse between writers and critics in his mind for there to be a potential golden age. When he said that, I almost thought back to a different world where Elizabeth Hardwick trained Daryl Pinkney on the Upper West Side, which just doesn't happen anymore. I guess, what efforts have you seen to expand criticism outside of the academy to, I guess, a larger audience and outside of also large publications?
I'm actually still stuck on Christian saying that acquires a healthy communion between writers and critics. I would not have expected him to say that. So I'm going to go listen to that interview to see what exactly he said. So I think that one thing we've seen, of course, is the explosion of all of these digital media forms that allow production of criticism at very different sizes and scales, and criticism that is geared towards increasingly specialized and self-selecting groups. So obvious example of this is probably Substack, where many writers who don't want to, who either can't or don't want to be caught up in the production processes of magazines, who know that what is valued increasingly is the timely take rather than the well thought out argument or intervention, are turning to these digital platforms in order to produce criticism with a particular purpose at a particular speed or pace. And you can see that most obviously in Substack, but you also see it in things like TikTok, Instagram. You used to see it on Twitter. I'm not on there anymore, so I don't actually know what has happened. But one of the very interesting consequences of this is that whether or not academics like it, criticism is being democratized. Mm-hmm. It might not be what they understand criticism to be. It might not do the same things that academic criticism does, and it doesn't even do the same things that a magazine piece does. But all of a sudden, more people than ever before are producing commentary about cultural objects. Mm-hmm. That commentary is circulating faster and wider than ever before. And I wouldn't want to claim that we're witnessing the mass democratization of criticism, because of course, all of this still requires literacy. Mm-hmm. And there are many people in this world who are not literate, and that literacy, the illiteracy rates are unequally distributed, of course, between the North and the Global South, between men and women, between white people and Black and brown people. So I would not want to make any sweeping claim about the mass democratization of literacy, but it does seem like this is perhaps the most democratic and the most widespread that the possibility for criticism has ever been. And as a result, the nature of criticism, what it looks like, what its various subgenres are, what social functions it serves, are also expanding in ways that I'm sure feel to me, as well as to everyone else, chaotic. There are two responses to moments of chaos. And we see this at a much earlier period in the history of criticism too. We see it right after World War II, when the rise of all of these mass cultural forms sent academic critics scurrying back into their classrooms in order to assert some kind of rational technical process for criticism at a point where everyone was being inundated with these mass cultural forms.
Yeah.
So one response to these moments of chaos or of destabilization or of what feels like cultural anarchy is to double down on tradition.
Yeah.
And to say, this is what we do. This is what criticism is. Criticism is close reading. Criticism is a certain kind of judgment that is practiced in the pages of the New Yorker. It is the New Yorker article. You know, whatever your definition or your genre of tradition might be, that is many people's responses, to double down on tradition and order and to say, here is what we assert in the face of chaos. Mm. Another response is to say, look, there is no stable definition of criticism the same way there's no stable definition of literature. These are historical categories that are always in movement. And the task of the critic at any age is to look at the historical category and to understand, yes, what came before it, but also how it must evolve in order to be of its time. Mm-hmm. That to me is what distinguishes really the greatest critics in the history of criticism, are the ones who are capable of seeing the category of criticism as well as the category of literature as a historical category that is always in movement, that must be tethered to the past, that comes out of the past, but also has to be open to the present. I think that all of us who practice criticism will have to thus take into account the way that the democratization of the digital is affecting what we do and who we speak to, who our publics are, and how we speak to those publics.
Fascinating. In terms of dissemination, which is sort of where I want to end up, you talked about genre expansion beyond the traditional written critic to TikTok and Instagram. And some people's bone to pick with that is a lack of nuance, which there is criticism that is not nuanced on TikTok, but I've also seen incredibly astute criticism on TikTok. And that sort of goes with the lack of a current space to disseminate everything. If Twitter acted as that space, just up for argument, until Elon bought it. What do you make of the fact that, A, on one side, criticism is expanding to various media, various genres, and then B, there is no centralized space to disseminate criticism. How do you make of this break?
I don't think it is a break. So I would just make two observations in response to your question. The first is that there are also plenty of forms of written criticism, and frankly, plenty of academic pieces of writing that are also not nuanced.
Yeah,
the ephemeral media of our time have no exclusive claim to stupidity.
This is true.
And on the flip side of that, like, look at what you and I are doing right now. What you and I are doing right now, having this conversation while I am in New Haven and you are in Middlebury, a conversation that will itself be disseminated and a conversation that is taking place through oral forms of criticism would not have been thinkable 15 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I'll even push that to 7 years ago.
Okay.
This would not have been thinkable. And I do not think that this is a conversation that in any way lacks nuance. So I think that we always have to consider what the relationship is between the mediums that are disseminating criticism, the people who are producing it and who have access to those mediums, audiences that are listening to them. Because I don't think it's very satisfying to say, well, TikTok is unnuanced, the same way it's not satisfying to say, well, academia is nuanced, because neither of those claims is true.
Yeah.
There's a lot more particularity brought to those claims. The second observation I would make is that anxieties about the lack of centralization in criticism are very, very old anxieties. In the 18th century, you see Joseph Addison writing in the early issues of The Spectator that the reason he is starting The Spectator is because he wants everyone to get access to or to have access to the same topic of conversation at the same time of day. Mm. Otherwise, you just have this hodgepodge of discourse. In the 19th century, you have Matthew Arnold lamenting that in England, there is nothing like the Literary Academy of France, which tells you which books you ought to read and puts its stamp of approval on those books so you know that the things you are reading have meet a certain standard of quality and can be distributed as such. In our age, you have all of this anxiety about the proliferation of different media forms, about the diminution of print, about the death of the novel. And none of these are new anxieties.
Yeah.
They're absolutely inherent to the public sphere, to just writing things and having them like move around the world in fundamentally ungovernable ways, or I should say in ways that can only be governed up to a point. So the reason I think it's really important to think historically about criticism and not to make claims about whether this is a dark age or a golden age or even an age at all is for the same reason I think it's really important to think historically about the category of crisis. Because if you see it as something that has been ongoing, if you see it as something that is inherent to the nature of, say, the humanities as a formation or the public sphere as the major space of civil society, then you will be a whole lot less anxious about things that we think are entirely new to us. At the same time, you can also, once you kind of clear the fog of anxiety, you can see what is new about this moment, and you can see what the new lends itself to, what the possibilities are that this moment makes clear or that it hands to us, and how you can take advantage of those possibilities in the most strategic way possible. I think many decisions now, both in media and in academia, are made out of a sense of despair and panic.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking historically, thinking sociologically, these are really good ways to get your panic and your despair in check.
On that note, my last question, what have you been reading, watching, or listening to lately that you've been excited about?
Gosh, I am on my annual reread of Middlemarch.
Okay.
7, and that, you know, really holds up, just a total delight. I am with my friend Tim reading Gerald Murnane's Inland.
Okay.
Which is being reissued in January by Another Stories Press. I think it was published initially by Dalkey, but it is so difficult to find editions of the Dalkey Inland. So I'm very, very glad that I have this new edition. So I'm reading Middlemarch, I'm reading Inland, and then for the class that I am teaching this week, we just read a series of wonderful essays by R.P. Blackmore and F.O. Matheson's The Responsibility of the Critic. I think next week we get all the kind of mid-century ladies writing about negative criticism. So Elizabeth Hardwick's On the Decline of Reviewing, Rebecca West's little piece in the New Republic on the duty of the harsh review, I think it's called, and then Renata Adler on the House Critic.
Okay.
Next week is the week on negative criticism. So I've been reading, Middlemarch, Gerald Murnane, and lots of pieces on the benefits of negative criticism in the pan.
Lovely.
What have you been reading?
What have I been reading? I am reading Dionne Brand's What We All Long for a class.
Fantastic. I think the last Dionne Brand I read was Theory. What's the Theory book? Do you remember?
I'm not sure. This is the only thing I've read by her.
Okay. How's it going?
It's good. I like it. It's interesting to think about another multicultural city because I've been thinking about London so much. And it's about Toronto. And it's fascinating to see the differences.
I love Toronto. Great city. But I'm also very eager to hear what comes out of your London project.
All right. I believe that's all I have. So thank you very much for your time. Great to have you here. And that's our show. Special thanks to Merve Emre for joining me on this episode. To learn more about her work and see a list of her recommendations, visit the show notes. Cultural Mixtapes is written and produced by me, Tejas Srinivasan. The music you heard on today's episode was Beethoven's Sonata No. 26 and Chopin's Sonata No. 2, recorded by me. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe, review, and share on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you listen. Thank you very much for listening.